Help.
The thought is father to the deed. Stuart Weiss, thank you so very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Stuart Weiss is professor of psychology at Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut. He's the author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. We thank the daddy of all production teams for this Mummy Show, Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Skeptic Check Mummy Dearest. You can find more Skeptic Check and more Big Picture Science on iTunes and through the link on our website. And while you're online, you can go to Facebook, become a fan of the program, and leave us a comment.
If you're a podcast listener, but you prefer over-the-air radio because you just love having E&M fields enveloping your body, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, well, consider letting them know you like the show. Hang on, this just in. The discovery of an ancient recording of an actual mummy's curse.
This linen wrapping is so f***ing itchy and tight. Somebody get me a f***ing pair of scissors. I can't even walk. God, just stubbed my f***ing toe. And where's my f***ing cappuccino?
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
This is Reba Neely, Promotions Coordinator for WHFR. 30 years ago, WHFR began making waves as the home of independent, non-commercial radio. From the management team, officers, and staff, thank you for being a part of the tide. WHFR, 30 years, and we're just getting started.
Hey, what's up? This is Tim from Alistair, and you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves.
This is Bob Allison. And you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is probably the most recognizable names in ufology, nuclear physicist and lecturer Stanton Friedman. Mr. Friedman was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by such companies as GM, GE, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet General Nucleonics. Oh, wow, that's a big word. And McDonnell Douglas, working in highly advanced classified programs such as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. He became interested in UFOs in 1958, and since 1967 has lectured about them at more than 600 colleges and 100 and for 100 professional groups in 50 states, in 10 Canadian provinces, and 18 other countries. He has published more than 90 UFO papers and has appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs, including Larry King Live, and numerous documentaries. Stan is the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident and co-authored Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. Since then, he has authored and co-authored many other books on the subject. He is a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada. So let's welcome to the show Mr. Stanton Friedman. Hello, Stan.
Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you back. We had you on quite a while ago. Cannot remember.
I don't remember exactly when it was. I'm getting old.
You're getting old?
Don't remember everything.
Gee, I'm staying the same age. What's the matter with you? No, I have it here. It was about eight years ago, anyway. So, and you were out here giving a lecture in Dearborn. Here at Henry Ford, remember?
Well, I've been at Henry Ford, yes.
Yes.
So. I drive Toyotas, but that's okay.
Well, we'll forgive you, okay. So anyway, on a personal note, you recently suffered a heart attack. How are you doing now?
Well, that was June 27th, and I'm doing fine. I had a couple of stents put in, and, you know, I lost a step on the way to third base, as they say. But I'm doing fine, and I figure, look, I turned 80. My parents both lived to be 90, so I got another 10 years to go, right?
At least. Yeah.
I'm still traveling and still speaking, and I'm a big mouth.
Well, that's good for us. We're here in the UFO community anyway, you know? And actually, for those who are not in the UFO community, if they'd only look at the evidence that you presented, and I've seen your... I've heard your presentation on flying saucers are real.
Okay, you know, I do several different ones just to break it up a little bit.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, that's a good one. I mean, you only use pictures that they could not fake so that, you know, back before computers. So that's good. That's good. So you have some... skeptics in the audience. You ever have hecklers in the audience?
I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk, so and the audience took care of the others.
They did.
I'm told you'll get more than that if you talk about sports, religion, politics. I don't talk about those things, but I don't worry about hecklers. When I first started a long time ago, I did worry about, are there going to be people who will destroy my case by providing evidence that I've never heard of, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, it hasn't happened. And the audience is, well, occasionally somebody wants to check how the audience feels. Had a full house out in Saskatchewan. And at the end of the lecture, somebody said, how about polling this audience? I had shown some Gallup poll data. And there are more believers than non-believers. And the greater the education, the more likely to believe in stuff. And I said, well, gee, normally I don't ask the audience to stick their necks out. That's my job. Well, I don't think anybody will mind, he said, and everybody clapped. So, okay, I asked two questions. How many of you believe some UFOs are alien spacecraft? And the second is, how many of you believe no UFOs are alien spacecraft? And fewer than 10% answered yes to the second one. In other words, 90 to 10, roughly.
Wow.
And I've done debates on Coast to Coast, for example. I was on with Dr. Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. the letters are right, anyway.
Yeah, it's really.
We did a long debate, and he polled the audience, and the calls indicated 57% on his side, on my side, rather, and 33% on his side, and 10% said, I don't know who won.
You're still on the
fence.
And
I debated with Michael Shermer of the Skeptics Society, and I got 80% of the vote versus 20% for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I'm not running scared, and People, I know that the main reason most people don't report their sightings is they're fearful of ridicule.
Yes.
But because I check, 10% of the people in my audiences typically have believed they've seen a flying saucer.
Really?
But 90% of them didn't report it.
That's right.
Because of fear of ridicule.
That's right. And I think the statistics bear that out. 10 to 11% of UFO sightings are never reported. And
well, 90% aren't reported.
I apologize. I meant it the other way around.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay.
10%, 11% are reported. The rest are not reported. So, yeah. So can you imagine the astounding number of... now, granted, 85, 90% of them are misidentifications.
But, well, that's true, but remember that that's true in a lot of other areas. What percentage of the ore that you dig at a gold mine is gold?
Right.
Well, a few ounces per ton.
Right.
How many drugs of all the chemicals around? How many cure a disease? Mm-hmm. Less than 1%. How many people are 7 feet tall? Basketball coach says, I don't care about that. Give me one.
Right.
One 7-footer, you know. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, and the biggest study of flying saucers ever done, Blue Book Special Report 14, 21.5% of 3,201 sightings couldn't be explained.
Right.
Completely separate from 9.3% listed as insufficient information. you know, so their sightings are not nearly as rare as some people think they are.
Right.
And you want to study the relevant evidence, and my primary focus is try to deal with the arguments made by the people who haven't studied the evidence and who look at things in several areas and don't understand the facts or don't have the facts. One is, you can't get here from there. How many times have I heard that?
Really?
And, you know, you can't on a bicycle, you can't go from Michigan to California in 20 minutes on a bicycle.
Mm.
But I'll tell you something. The space station goes around the whole planet in 90 minutes.
Right.
You know.
Well, that theory is based on the fact that we can't get there from here.
At this point in time, but if you look back 100 years, let's say 120, we didn't know that there were neutrons. Mm. We didn't know there were gamma rays, X-rays, DNA, fission, fusion.
Right.
You know, all kinds of things we didn't know about. We're a primitive society.
Yes, yes.
You can tell that just by how many people we kill. How many were killed this past week and bad things happening to good people, you know.
Yeah, so.
But it's really strange. We do know enough to go to the stars if we want to spend the money. And that's the thing, that one area I spent 14 years working on advanced systems. More canceled programs than anybody, I will say.
What was the reason for that?
Why the cancellation? Yeah. Well, not because I was there, because they ran out of dough.
I wasn't.
Somebody didn't have guts enough. One of my heroes, and I don't have many, but one of them is Admiral Hyman Rickover, who led the battle to have a nuclear navy.
Mm.
And he was very successful. That is, we wound up with submarines that could go around the world underwater.
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, we heard a lot about the submarine menace, but you can only stay under for a day.
Mm-hmm.
You need little oxygen for the motors, you know.
Right.
He also pushed for the development, and the battleship boys didn't go along with this, but Rickover won. We have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers.
Mm-hmm.
That can operate for 18 years without refueling.
Wow.
That's very impressive to me, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I worked on a fusion propulsion system. You know, what's really crazy is there are a number of astronomers who are anti-UFO, ignorant as heck as they are, but and every astronomer knows that the process that produces the energy in the stars is nuclear fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that we have conquered nuclear fusion. We have built hydrogen bombs. Those are nuclear fusion devices. So it's not like we're talking about imaginary stuff.
Right.
I worked on a study of nuclear fusion for deep space propulsion back in 1962. I was just a wee lad at the time, you understand?
Of course.
But my point is, we already know. Well, let me give you a little sequence. A big bomb could release the energy of 10 tons of dynamite in 1944. 10 tons.
Mm-hmm.
Make a big hole in the ground, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a 10-ton blockbuster. Well, okay, first atomic bomb fission device released the energy of 17,000 tons of dynamite. That was in 1945. 1952, our first hydrogen bomb released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT.
I'd lie.
And the Russians, a few years later, set off the big bomb, 50 million tons of TNT energy release in one lousy bomb.
Wow.
And I mean lousy bomb. My point is this. If you use fusion for deep space propulsion, you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket.
Mm-hmm.
So we know how to do it now, whether we should. I'm sure nobody out there would want us out there.
Really? I mean,
look at our history.
Right.
Yeah, we had a big war. We killed 50 million people. This year we spend $1 trillion on things military.
Mm-hmm.
We're not nice guys.
Not really.
And it surprises people, incidentally, that we have actually exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. Only two on people, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But 800, or I don't know why that number comes up, 2,000 nuclear weapons have been exploded here.
2,000.
So we're not nice guys. I'm glad there haven't been more. And I'm a nuclear guy, but I'd rather... We have operated fission nuclear propulsion systems.
Mm.
Very impressive. Los Alamos tested the biggest one, almost 7 feet in diameter, the Phoebus 2B, nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system. Way back in 69, released the energy, well, it operated at a power level of 4,400 megawatts. Now, Grand Coulee Dam produces 2,000 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
So twice the energy output of Grand Coulee Dam, less than 7 feet in diameter.
Wow.
So it's not, I mean, if you use that as an upper stage to go to Mars, let's say, you could triple the payload that you could get there compared with chemical rockets.
Mm. What do you?
Go ahead. We know how to do these things. I'm not saying we should spend the dough. We certainly have better things to spend money on.
Mm-hmm.
Than going to the stars, because if we go to the stars, it's my contention it should be with a planetary system,
right?
Not a nationalistic one, yes. An American or a Russian or a Chinese or whatever.
I don't see that happening real soon.
No, I don't either. I don't either. I mean, I've got a great grandson. I hope by the time he grows to be my age, that maybe it will happen.
Yeah,
but when we realize that there are advantages for the people on the planet. Not for the bomb makers, but for the people. For us all to act together and spend our energy other ways than in warfare.
No.
We're addicted.
Afraid we are. Well, what do you think about the theory of UFOs of electromagnetic propulsion system?
Well, okay. I said in my... God forbid how long ago it was, 1968 congressional testimony, that, and it's the reason, really, that I mentioned the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, because they carry about 75 little aircraft, small jets, fast ones, and they can operate for about 2 hours without refueling, and a carrier for 18 years. So we got a mothership, and the carrier's big, and little... jets. Well, we have motherships coming between the stars and little, I call them Earth excursion modules, flitting around in the atmosphere. And the ones that crash are the little ones, not the big ones.
Right.
Now, I have strongly suggested that probably the little ones use a magneto-aerodynamic propulsion system. You ionize the air around the craft, you interact with electric and magnetic fields, and you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, all nice things.
Mm.
And my last job in industry, next to last job, McDonnell Douglas, I had a literature search done of the government technical report literature, not the open scientific literature, government technical reports, using one key word, magneto-aerodynamics.
Mm.
And I got 900 references, of which 90% were classified.
Hmm.
So somebody is looking into that
right area.
So, and incidentally, if people think I'm just spouting science fiction, there have been two electromagnetic submarines.
Oh, yeah?
Seawater is an electrically conducting fluid. We don't think of it that way, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Stuart Way of Westinghouse Research Labs and a bunch of students, he was on leave for a year at University of California, Santa Barbara, they built an electromagnetic submarine, less than 10 feet long, and you have electric and magnetic fields at right angles to each other. That gives you a current at right angles to both, and you zip along silently slipping through the seawater.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese built one that was more powerful. They used superconducting magnets, no resistance to the flow of the current
mm-hmm.
that produces the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a direct analogy with real systems. We're not talking science fiction here. There was a movie, Hunt for Red October.
Right.
Clancy. Which really was looking at sort of an electromagnetic submarine. So I'm thinking, you know, when you go to computers, when I was young a long time ago, I used a slide rule to make calculations. And when I gave a talk at the University of Detroit, as a matter of fact, I was saying how much times had changed and that when I worked in industry, I was using a slide rule. Got no reaction, so I asked, anybody here know what a slide rule is? Not one of the students did. Which made me feel a little ancient.
Yeah, really?
Now we use a little electromagnetic devices, don't we? You know,
isn't that one of those
calculators?
Things, isn't that one of those Chinese things with the beads that go?
Abacus.
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm being facetious. And I must take one short break here just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. The station making waves. It's 89.3 FM on your radio and WHFR.FM on your computer. So you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with nuclear physicist Mr. Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman, let me see. I got a list of your questions.
Huh? StantonFriedman.com.
That's where we can contact or find out more about his work is StantonFriedman.com. Yeah. Now, you have successfully debated some of the most notable skeptics over the years. You were talking about that earlier. So what are some of the skeptics' arguments for the non-existence of UFOs, and how do you answer them? You already talked about they can't get here from there. What are some of the others?
Well, you can't keep secrets.
Uh-huh.
And there are people who will tell you that everything is automatically declassified after 25 years, and governments can't keep secrets. And I have to point out, as I do in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, I guess, when I talk about the cosmic Watergate, that there have been many large-scale, multi-billion-dollar programs that were kept secret for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me give you an example. The Brits figured out how to break the German codes, the communication codes,
mm-hmm.
the Enigma machine, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that early in the war, and we were reading German military mail and then later Japanese mail. Now, the fact that we had broken the codes was not made public until 25 years after the end of the war. There were 12,000 people at Bletchley Park in England who were intercepting, decoding, translating, and carefully releasing the messages.
Mm.
12,000 people kept their mouths shut for 25 years. The Manhattan Project, of course, was billions of dollars, and many people don't realize that the facility that was built to separate uranium isotopes, when make a nice bomb, you use enriched uranium-235. Mm. It starts off with only 0.7%. Uh-oh, we got a problem. What did we do? We built a mile-long, literally, gaseous diffusion plant at Oak Ridge, became Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And would you believe it was using 5% of all the electricity produced in the United States at that time?
Wow.
In secret.
Yeah.
In secret.
What year was this?
All during the war, from 43 on, 45, and then operated for years after that, too.
Wow.
But, and that's why it was in Oak Ridge, because TVA was producing electricity, lots of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tennessee Valley Authority. And so there's an example. Well, last year, the Washington Post pointed out that the total black budget for military intelligence, that is, doesn't show on Congress's books, was $52.6 billion. And the three big guys were NSA, CIA, and NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. Hmm. That's a lot of secrecy.
Well, you say that they don't want to spend the dough. I wonder how much of that dough you're talking about now is being used for just that type of project, reaching the stars.
Don't know, and I don't have any way of finding out. And there are some people who say we've been there, Project Serpo. We sent off a bunch of guys, and they stayed there, and some of them came back, and so forth. And I have that firmly in my gray basket.
Mm-hmm.
I've read quite a bit, but I am not convinced that it really happened.
Yeah, me too. Serpo, I don't know that much about it because I have read some of Serpo's stuff and said, you know what, I think they're going a little too far here without any kind of evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're saying, you can say anything you want. If you don't have the evidence, then, might as well keep
going. Why should I believe it?
That's it.
Right.
That's it.
And also, the reason they don't know about security... I was just talking to an archivist at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division, and he thinks all the documents at presidential libraries and stuff like that have all been scanned, and they're on a computer.
Hmm.
And no, they haven't.
Hmm.
And I asked about, I had spent time there looking at the files of General Nathan Twining, for example, and had a bunch of boxes, it's about 130 boxes of his materials, declassified, but there are still four boxes of top secret material, and he died a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
It is not all declassified at all, and I get other people tell me, Stan, look, it's all open after 25 years.
Hmm.
No, it isn't. And I get other people, I've been a strong enthusiast about the Operation Majestic 12 papers, three of them.
Right.
There's 100 phony ones. I don't care about them. And people who say that you can't keep secrets like that, and the scholars dig out all the secrets from World War II and afterwards, and they don't realize that the secrets that have been dug out are because the government has stopped classifying that, like breaking the German codes. After 25 years, there were different machines, different systems, et cetera. It didn't matter.
Or you've got insider whistleblowers.
Well, yeah, whistleblowers, that sounds good, but you've got Mr. Snowden, for example, and he released a lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
But he isn't wandering around the country, is he?
No.
There aren't many whistleblowers around. Look, I get people saying to me about the Majestic 12 documents that surely those guys would have told their wives what they were doing.
Not necessarily, no.
And I'm sorry, I worked under security for 14 years. I never told my wife anything classified.
No.
I'd be a darn fool to do that.
Right, right.
It's against the law, for one thing. But more importantly, loose lips sink ships.
Right.
You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They read the newspapers.
Right.
I don't know who my wife's going to say something to that somebody else might hear.
Right.
You know, that's not how the systems work.
That's right.
Let me give you an example, a different kind of example. One of the people on Majestic 12, according to me and the documents, was Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy, who wrote three anti-UFO books. Three. How could he be on a committee which knew that flying saucers were real, that there'd been a Roswell crash, et cetera, et cetera? And people say, it's impossible. Well, I found out, because I worked at it and stumbled across some information which led me to the right place, that he told Jack Kennedy that he had a longer continuous association with the NSA, the National Security Agency, and its Navy intelligence predecessor of anybody in the country. And I found that at the Harvard archives. That didn't come third hand. I made a copy of the letter from Menzel to Jack. When we are properly cleared to each other, he said, I can tell you more. Menzel wasn't happy about what the Eisenhower administration had done with the NSA. This is a guy who everybody says was the biggest debunker. Nobody knew that he had a top secret Umbra clearance, which he did. That was kept secret for a very long time. The documents didn't come out until all the original members were dead. So I can't ask any of them any. Well, I don't know how. Maybe there are people who can, but I can't.
Yeah. So you bring this up about Kennedy. There are rumors that one of the reasons, or the reason that Kennedy was shot, was assassinated, was because he was about to release the fact that we were being visited by extraterrestrial beings. And
I've heard that. I don't know if it's true or not. I haven't seen any evidence for that, but what can I say? I can't say it couldn't possibly have been. But I'm not a historian. I'm just a dumb old physicist. What do I know about assassinations? You know.
I think the main reason really was not to get off topic here, but I think the main reason was that we were in Vietnam. We had corporate interests in Vietnam, and he was going to pull us out. Oh no!
Well, that makes as much sense to me as anything else.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I do know that Donald Menzel had a top secret Umbra clearance, was a world-class cryptographer, taught cryptography, as a matter of fact, classified for the Navy. Would you believe he enlisted when he was 40 years old in the Navy and spent 3 years working on classified stuff, helping out, doing his share. And after the war, he was head of the Naval Reserve Communications Unit Number 1 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for many years. I talk about him in my books, in Top Secret Magic, the book about MJ-12 and stuff. But when I have people say, I don't believe you, I say, have you studied the evidence? I'm a little sneaky. If I talk about five large-scale scientific studies, as I usually do, I talk about them, show a slide, a couple slides, data. Then I ask, how many people here have read this? Almost never do I get as many as 2%. So I'm perfectly willing, when somebody says, well, I'm sure you can come to other conclusions than the ones you have. Somebody said this to me after a dinner and a lecture, and I said, well, as I recall, you hadn't read any of those five studies that I mentioned, had you? Well, no. Well, that's the difference between us, I said. I give you my conclusions. I refer you to the evidence on which I based my conclusion. You haven't read any of those reports. I've read them all. whose opinion is worth more?
Really?
Long silence after
I was going to say, they shut up then, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
And, you know, it's weird. There is a strong will not to believe among certain groups of people about flying saucers. Part of it is ego.
Mm-hmm.
I've named a new disease. Remember David Susskind had a television show,
right.
Talk show?
Right.
Sharp guy. I had a call from him when I was living in California a long time ago. He wanted to do a show about UFOs and wanted a good skeptic. I said, there aren't any, but here's how to reach Phil Klass and here's how to reach Betty Hill and so forth.
Yeah.
Oh, and a good recent sighting in the coin case, which happened in Ohio, had happened just shortly before that. So I told him how to reach one of those guys. So we all go off to New York and to do his show. And it was done in segments. And between takes, segments, he tells me, look, I read the New York Times. I don't see anything in there that establishes that flying saucers are real. So the syndrome is I keep track of what's important in the world. And if this were true, it would certainly be important. And if it was being covered up, that would be important. But if it were, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. And I'm not going to waste my time on something that is obviously not going to be productive.
Right. Why should I waste my time looking at the evidence, right?
That's right. Don't bother me. There are four basic rules for debunkers in any field, but especially in UFOs. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier and nobody will know the difference. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble. It's easy to say there is no evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm there, I can argue with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but a lot of people can't, so they get away with it. You know, do your homework. I learned that in grade school.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to take on a teacher, you better have the evidence or she's going to give you a very hard time.
That's right. That's right.
Those 49-cent a volume encyclopedias sure came in handy to me.
If people say that there's no evidence, I'll say to them, how many books have you read on the UFO subject? Well, none, you know. How many documentaries have you seen? Well, I don't watch that because,
I know it's baloney.
Yeah, it's baloney, so why should I waste my time? So I said, well, that's why you don't. No, it's not that there's no evidence. You don't know that there's evidence because you don't look at it. So
right. That's true. So I don't worry about it. I don't have a problem with it. Well, I'll give you an example. State University of New York in Cortland, New York. First guy up in the question and answer period, well-dressed, speaks well. I've never heard so much nonsense in one night in my life, he says. Great way to start the question and answer period. So my response, fortunately, was sensible. I couldn't have told you what I would have said, but you know, what I did say was, can you be a bit more specific, please, sir? You said that Betty and Barney Hill were taken to Zeta Reticuli and back in 2 hours. No, sir. What I said was they were taken on board a craft. They didn't go anywhere. We're kept there for 2 hours. He asked another question, which I had to say, no, that's not what I said, exactly the opposite. And the third question, finally somebody in the audience stood up and said, how about taking some sensible questions? The guy left. He walked right out. And I said, I'll take your question, but who was that? He was a professor of physics.
Oh.
He didn't hear what I said.
No. No, and he twisted it. It sounds like he twisted what you said.
Well, what he expected me to say, I guess. Anything yeah. stupid.
Yeah. Those are always the explanations. The explanations that don't fit the evidence, and they criticize you for saying something you didn't say.
That you'd think people would know more about.
Hmm?
I was just reading over. I'm working on a new book, maybe with Kathleen Marden, with whom I wrote "Captured: The Betty and Barney Hill Experience." She's Betty's niece. And we also wrote Science Was Wrong,
right.
14 chapters, each stimulated by some smart guy saying something stupid.
Mm-hmm. I've read them both. You know, they're great.
Man will never fly in an airplane, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we're looking at Dr. Menzel and from Harvard that I was talking about, and I noticed in his congressional testimony, right next to mine, in the proceedings of the 1968 symposium. And he talks about the nearest place would have to be hundreds of light years away. Now, he was too smart an astronomer not to know that that was nonsense. There are 2,000 stars within 54 light years of here. And I just read somebody has done I'll call it a census of the stars. There are 260,000 stars within 250 light years. That's a pretty good selection.
I guess so. And judging by where we were 100 years ago and where we are today, where they must be, given science tells us we're a fairly new planet, fairly new solar system.
Well, certainly fairly new civilization.
So where can they be in their...
You mean there's somebody smarter than us?
Oh, come on. But there's another reason people don't want to accept that. You know, right now we're king of the hill, masters of the universe, smartest things out there. And oh my gosh, if you show me that's mistaken. Where is our place in the universe? Oh, you know, they don't want to admit that. They're not ready to admit that.
Well, you're so right. And you know, it wasn't, let's say, 60 years ago. Frank Drake, the SETI community, 10 years ago, said there might be as many as 8,000 planets in the galaxy that could be sending us radio signals. And now, thanks to Kepler, we might say, well, there's probably a billion planets in the galaxy that could send us radio signals. And we were on top of the heap. But the heap has fallen down.
I'm afraid so. I've got to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, station making waves, 89.3 FM. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Mr. Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. And you mentioned, Stan, that... Kathleen Martin, she was on the show just last month. And now correct me if I'm wrong, but when you first became involved with the UFO phenomenon, you were more interested in the nuts and bolts craft as opposed to alien abduction. So when did you first become involved with that aspect?
Well, I didn't know anything about alien abduction. I knew a lot about nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
And so... I think the star map got me moving in the right direction.
Explain the star map to those.
Kathy's aunt, Betty Hill, and her husband, Barney Hill, were taken on board a saucer in 1961 in New Hampshire. And it's been written originally... John Fuller's book, The Interrupted Journey. Then Kathy and I, just a few years ago, did a book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. But as part of that experience, Betty was being examined by these aliens. She was a specimen. You know, I think you'd call it a catch-and-release program.
Right.
And she asked the leader of this group. She and Barney were in separate rooms. Just down the street in New Hampshire. They didn't go to the places that these guys originated. Anyway, she asked them, the leader, where are you from? I know you're not from around here, understatement of the month.
Not from this neighborhood, anyway.
Yeah. And he shows her what I'll describe as a three-dimensional map, call it a model, whatever it was, points of light which were stars connected by different kinds of lines. Heavy trade routes, light trade routes, occasional expeditions, and a couple of dozen stars. And she's looking at this, and she says to him, well, where are you on the map? The map's about 3 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet, not huge. And he asks her, well, do you know where you are on the map? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. And this comes out under hypnosis by Dr. Benjamin Simon, one of the world's experts at the time on what we today call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And he's using hypnosis, which he used to treat thousands of shell shock war veterans, to get him back amongst the living. And Betty and Barney certainly had a traumatic experience.
Right.
And so she's telling this story about the map, and he asks her if she can remember what it looks like. She says yes. This is under hypnosis. So he gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion. If and only if you can remember it accurately, draw it later on. So she goes home, and she draws it and brings it in a couple of weeks, and it's in the first book, The Interrupted Journey. And the trouble is, you got no reference points. Who knows where the heck this is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a woman named Marjorie Fish in Ohio, a school teacher, heard about this, read the book, and called Betty and went to visit her. She was thinking maybe she could build a map, a model to check on the map. And she's built more than 20 of them.
Hmm.
Her biggest one had 256 stars in it. That's an awful lot of work, copying out numbers, because they wouldn't let her take the star catalogs out of the Ohio State University Library.
Oh.
And she, to make a long story short, she kept eliminating stars because scientists said, well, this kind of star won't have life and so forth. Anyway, she wound up with one and only one match. Angle for angle, line length for line length, matched what Betty had drawn.
Wow.
And the base stars turn out to be Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the constellation of Reticulum, the net.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only, now we know, they're 39.3 light years away from us and only an eighth of a light year apart from each other, 30 times closer to each other than we are to the next star over.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I looked at that work, I had been asked to help her out by the head of the Ergophenomena Research Organization. And I belonged to NICAP and APRO, and NICAP wasn't interested in anything about aliens. We got craft, but ain't nobody on board, I guess. Seemed to be the attitude.
Yeah.
So I got a chance to meet Betty, and when we made my movie of UFOs Are Real in 1978, we traveled around the country, it was at her home. But I also had been very lucky before that. When I was living in Pittsburgh, I had done a lot of shows on KDKA, which I think you guys get up there sometimes, radio, late night, whatever.
Don't know.
Big TV and radio station.
Okay.
And I had done a show. That's how I got started. I did a show called, would you believe, Contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a guest, and somebody at work at Westinghouse heard me on the show, wanted me to speak to their book review club, and I did, and I gave a lot more talks. That was my start. Anyway, the station trusted me, and they called and told me that Betty and Barney were coming to town, and they told me where they were staying, which is very unusual, as you know.
Yeah.
And so I called them, and we went out. We had dinner together. And that got me. I was very impressed with them.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the late 60s still, and it was before the star map work got done.
Mm-hmm.
But Betty and I did a number of shows after that. Barney died just a few months later, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So it was back then that I got interested in abductions, didn't do much about it until Kathleen and I, and besides the star map, I was the first to publish about the star map work.
All right.
But Kathleen has, as Betty's niece, has all the tapes of the hypnosis sessions, 10 each. Incidentally, Dr. Simon was so impressed that he had to stop one session each with Betty and with Barney because he wasn't sure they could take it. The emotional upset was every bit as great, he said, as in any of those shell shock war veterans that he dealt with. Now, coming from him, that's meaningful. He ran a hospital. 3,000 patients with PTSD.
Yeah.
And so that got me started, and it's not my primary area of interest. Kathy knows much more about abductions than I do.
Mm-hmm.
She's a certified hypnotist. I'm
Right.
I'll tell you one thing, though. I took a course. My son had hemophilia, and one way to stop bleeding may be use of hypnosis a long, long time ago. And once in class, the professor put a girl, he regressed her. She was in her late 20s, took her back to 20 and 15, finally like 8. Her 8th birthday, he thought that would be a safe time. And she, her voice changes, you know, and so forth. Mm. And she burst into tears. It turns out her father had died on her 8th birthday.
Oh, my.
And I was so glad that there was somebody there who could handle that, because she was upset.
Certainly.
You know, she didn't want to relive that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have stayed away from that aspect of things, because I think it should be done by people with proper training.
That's right.
You know, and who are concerned. Mm. And Dr. Simon, who did the hypnosis, certainly was.
Mm.
So I look at a lot of different aspects, but I'll leave the hypnosis and stuff to Kathy.
To someone else. Okay, we only have like maybe 8 minutes now, but let's talk for a while briefly about your latest book with Robert Salas, Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, How the World Governments Have Conspired to Conceal Humanity's Biggest Secret. That's quite a title.
Well, now this is Bob Salas's book. This I wrote a foreword for it.
Oh, okay.
And I encouraged him and so forth. But,
okay.
Well, it's appropriate for me in the sense that his story involves the shutting down of ICBMs with nuclear warheads on them.
Mm, yeah.
And that's pretty scary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was down in the hole, so to speak, at one of these facilities in Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. And he gets a call from somebody, a guard on the surface. Hey, there's, you know, effectively a UFO flying around here. And Bob thought, well, call me when something happens. He wasn't taking them very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And a few minutes later, he called back and obviously was agitated. And, you know, it's right over the gate and, you know, I don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob reacted by checking on things. And suddenly, 10 missiles go offline, one after the other. Now, everybody says that can't be done because they're independently wired. You know, nobody wants, if there's a problem, that it should knock all the missiles out. This is our first line of defense.
Right.
And so there were all kinds of investigations, and as Bob has written in his book, he's found out that it happened at several other places.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, and also even in the Soviet Union, and so... It, to me, strikes a responsive chord because I've had people say, why would anybody come here anyway? And if they did come here, why don't they land and talk to the president? And I think, you know, how naive can you get?
Right.
In the first place, the president of the United States does not speak for 7 billion earthlings.
Mm.
He has trouble speaking for 310 million Americans. And there's 1.3 billion Chinese out there and a billion people in India. And the president doesn't speak for all these people.
No.
Secondly, Washington's a no-fly zone. But much more important,
like
I've got a list in one of my books of why anybody would come here. But I think the chief list would be to quarantine us.
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, we killed 50 million of our own kind. As I said earlier, we have exploded 2,000 nuclear warheads. This year we'll spend $1 trillion on things military.
Right.
Thousands of kids die every single day of preventable disease or starvation. You know, why would anybody think we were nice guys? The important thing would be to make sure that we don't go out there to bother them, taking our brand of friendship. Everybody else calls it hostility, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that... you know, it's easy to tell that we've tested nuclear weapons. You do air sampling, and there have been a lot of them.
Right.
That tells anybody visiting that soon these idiots would be able to bother us.
Right. And with all the nuclear weapons we have, with all the nuclear weapons we have worldwide, if, you know, E.T. knows about this, which obviously they do. They seem to be attracted to our nuclear power plants, our nuclear weapons storage, et cetera, et cetera. Then I think they're worried about also about us blowing ourselves up, and that would affect many other. I mean, it's a chain reaction. It would probably be a chain reaction, don't you think?
Well,
just like the atom bomb itself.
Well, it may well be that they have been using stuff from here for a long time. This may be a source of A, B, C, or D. You know, it turns out, surprisingly, Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. In other words, a cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any of the other planets.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, so what? Well, it turns out heavy metals are more common here than they are on the other planets, and dense heavy metals have special properties like uranium and gold and osmium and rhenium. Those two are twice as dense as lead. And you know what we used uranium for 100 years ago? A yellow coloring agent on dinner tableware.
So all you have to do.
That's not what we use it for anymore. It's illegal to do that.
I was going
to
say, all you have to do is get a hold of a bunch of old plates, scrape them off, and make a bomb. I could be wrong.
They may be after the diamonds that come off the waters of Africa, the ocean.
Could be.
You know, we're using nuclear submarines under the ocean to threaten other people who also have nuclear submarines.
Huh?
They may be gathering diamonds or nodules of all kinds of goodies down there.
Yeah.
We don't know. But if we make a mess out of the place, it makes harvesting awfully difficult.
That's right. So we also had Art Campbell on the show talking about
yes.
his book, UFO Crash at St. Augustine. And
yes.
in 47, it was Roswell, and you did the book on the crash at Corona, which, you know.
We talk about the plains of St. Augustine in there.
Okay. So is Corona and Augustine one in the same crash, or were there three crashes?
No. Plains of St. Augustine is about 100 miles west of where Roswell happened.
Okay.
And it was about the same time.
Yeah.
I think, frankly, that there was a mid-air collision.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, why do you think that? Well, because I know that the radar was on, because back then it was vacuum tube radar. You don't see many vacuum tubes anymore.
No.
And the reason it would be on is because they take a long time to warm up.
Mm-hmm.
And they were expecting a rocket test. So it would probably be the only place in the world at that time where a saucer, there were... They often, 40% of the cases involve more than one object seen in traveling with another object.
Mm.
You'd expect that it would be very rare for a saucer to run into a radar beam.
Right.
Because there certainly weren't many of them around then.
Right.
And if it discombobulated the guidance system or the power supply, there might have been a mid-air collision.
Mm-hmm.
I asked a retired general who had been a pilot during World War II and who wound up being head of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 60s, and I asked him, if you have a mid-air collision, is the damage usually symmetric that is the same to the two airplanes? No, he said. Usually one makes it down and one survives.
Hmm.
So one account of the plains of St. Augustine says that there was a gash, like two parentheses, in that one.
Hmm.
That sounds like it might have been hit by another one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And
so,
just a short blast, but now.
So there are altogether three craft involved in the Roswell incident. Is that
no correct? Two?
Two. We're back to that again.
One went this way and crashed, exploded above the ground. Near Corona, actually.
All right.
And the other one crashed, stuck on the side of a hill, the plains of St. Augustine. There was a third crash in Aztec, New Mexico,
right.
March of 1948.
Right.
There's an excellent book, The Aztec Incident, by Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. Her family lives near that part of New Mexico, northwestern New Mexico, right in the Four Corners area there.
Mm-hmm.
And they have dug up an awful lot of evidence. We used to think that was just a silly story, but They found a lot of evidence.
Yeah, I've read their book. I've had them on the show. And they really combed the area before they made any drew any conclusions or wrote the book.
Yeah.
And they did their homework for years. So
that's right.
And did their investigation.
I recommend their book,
yes,
The
indeed.
Aztec Incident.
Yeah.
And I recommend Art's book, too.
Yeah.
He spent a lot of time. He lives in Oregon, so he's a lot closer to it than I am.
Yeah.
And I've shared information with him and witnesses and so forth. So, yeah, there are some serious and competent researchers around. Mm. You've just named several of them, Ramses and Art and so forth.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but I want our listeners to know where they can go to check out more of your work.
Okay, www.stantonfriedman.com. And it lists my books and my DVDs and has some articles that you can read and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, get acquainted with the data.
That's right. There is, you know, buying the books is good, but you've got some of the data right on the site. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so that would be enticing as well. So stantonfriedman.com. That's hard to remember, isn't it?
Not difficult.
Okay. So anyway.
Not even for us old guys.
No. So, Stan, I appreciate you coming on the show. And
it's my pleasure.
I hope we can do this again.
Okay. Well, I got to be around first, but.
Yeah, you'll be around. You'll be
I
around.
Hope so.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Good night.
And if our listeners have any comments or questions for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the talk shows and on the homepage, and then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. So until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Loyal listeners, please save the date. February 21st, 2015. WHFR 89.3 FM will present our first annual Meet the DJ benefit, celebrating our 30th year of local, independent, non-commercial radio at the fabulous Oakwood Bar and Grill, 17621 Oakwood Boulevard in Dearborn, Michigan, right off the Southfield Expressway.